The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We absolutely support Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law.
We need to safeguard financial stability.
2024 is not going to be an easy year.
We used to call it the dream of home ownership, but look at Britain now.
We've got to hang on to optimism and hope because it is the biggest driver of change.
Let's stop thinking of life in terms of Brexit. Let's move on and look to the future.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm James Woolcock.
Welcome to the programme. Today we're going to return to an issue that dominated much of yesterday's Prime Minister's questions, the controversial comments by the Tory donor Frank Hester that targeted the Labour MP before she lost the whip, Diane Abbott. This is a subject that we heard the leader of the Conservative and Labour parties discuss yesterday, but Diane Abbott's been writing in a number of newspapers today about her treatment, attacking the Conservatives, the Labour Party and the Speaker for not taking her question during Prime Minister's questions, allowing her to contribute to that discussion as well. And The Guardian, she writes that race, whether explicitly or implicitly, is at the heart of the debate in British politics, and the issue is not just about a particular political party, but all of their institutions. In The Independent, she took aim at both parties, saying that while the Tory reluctance to call out racism and sexism is shocking, it's hardly surprising, while the position of the current leadership of the Labour Party is disappointing. She says it seems equally reluctant at the outset to call out either racism or sexism. This is becoming an even bigger story in the political world, James.
Well, yeah, look, it's clearly plastered all over the press this morning, Stephen, but like, underneath the media froth, there are broadly three prongs to this, to my mind, which is, number one, the racism and the alleged racism towards Diane Abbott and what that says about the state of political debate in the country for someone who is, you know, the first black female MP in Parliament. The second here is what this says about the Conservative Party management and how Rishi Sunak's party seems to be in a very, very febrile position on its fourth leader in one government facing an election year. And that election year, £10 million is not a small amount of money for a political party, especially in election year, is also going to be, is this just the harbinger of quite a toxic debate to come? And so, very pleased to say, we're joined a bit earlier today by our political editor, Kitty Donaldson, to dig into this.
The kettle lid's sort of blowing off. Yes, they're really depressed this week. And part of that's down to sort of news management, as you said, took the number 10 nearly sort of 12 hours to change their minds and decide that perhaps saying, you know, you want to shoot a black woman is perhaps racist after all. So they're cross about that, added to which they are upset that the Prime Minister seems distant. I think there's a detail in the story. If not, I'll tell you anyway. He went to the 1922 reception on Monday night. The 1922 committee is basically the name given to all the backbench MPs, and it's a way of keeping in touch with the mood of the parliamentary Tory party. And they had a reception on the terrace of the House of Commons, and apparently he stayed for sort of 15 to 20 minutes and then sort of zipped off. And one person there said to me, well, is he hiding from us? What's going on? Why won't he engage? So there's that kind of worry that, you know, number 10 have turned into a bunker and they're not taking proper advice. And then, on top of which, what had been bubbling under for quite a long time now was shall we hang on till the, for the Tories, shall we hang on till November, October, November, go to the country then, because the economy will pick up. There might be some surprise wins in the local elections. Ben Houchen might hold on, well, the regional mayors. Andy Street might hold on. Susan Hall in London might come a close second to Sadiq Khan in the first round of voting. You know, it might not be a complete washout for the Tories at the local elections on May the 2nd. Plus, the economy might improve. We might get a flight in the air, they say, to Rwanda, because the Rwanda bill is going to parliamentary ping pong next week, which means it goes backwards and forwards between the House of Commons and House of Lords, and then it's enacted, we think, probably by Thursday. So we're getting close to a Rwanda flight. And then something kind of snapped over the weekend, and I think it probably was the Hester comments and the reaction to it. And sort of all the kind of the seesaw that said let's keep going till the autumn fell down the other side, and people started saying, I don't think we can go on like this. I think this is like the wheels have come off. This is so bad. And then, as Alex Wickham and I wrote in the story this morning, members of the cabinet are now having private discussions among themselves as to what to do in the event that someone tries to topple Sunak. And that's not to say he's about to fall. I think we need to make that incredibly clear to people. But partly he's propped up because there is no one else.
Yeah.
He's propped up by his own frailty, because to get rid of him now would look absolutely insane to voters, right? But also no one who wants to be leader of the opposition after the election, or leader of the Conservative Party, if, as expected, the Tories lose, why would you own the defeat now? Why would you take over if you're a Penny Mordaunt character, if you're a Kemi Badenoch character? Why would you do it now? You'd wait, right? And then own the defeat, and then come along and, you know, lead the party from opposition.
But this issue, I'm kind of wondering why this has reached, you know, of everything that's happened over the past weeks and months, why this is the issue that's pushed it to this level of sort of rumblings behind the scenes. And is it because of the nature of the comments themselves, the racist undertones, or is this entirely an issue about Tory party management?
I think it's both. And people are comparing it to Chris Pincher, the Chris Pincher moment that brought down Boris Johnson. If you remember when, from the start of the year that ended with Johnson falling, we'd been, I don't know, I'd have questions every day. Is he about to fall? Is he about to fall? You know, and we sort of said, no, it's all right. And then very quickly in the summer, after the Pincher, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. He was accused, Chris Pincher was then the deputy chief whip, I think, and he was accused of groping in a bar. But it was Boris Johnson's defence of him that meant and he made ministers go out and defend him on the airwaves, and then changed his mind. And that's what happened with Hester, is that on Monday morning, ministers were sent out on the broadcast airwaves and made to defend Hester and, you know, not pronounce him racist. And then sort of Kemi Badenoch came along and basically outflanked the Prime Minister by saying, yes, he is racist, or he made racist comments. And from that point on, Sunak was on the back foot. So it's the kind of looking stupid, and it's something that Labour can absolutely sort of hone in on, even though, of course, Labour has its own problems with different types of racism.
Where does this go from here? I mean, is there a world in which this all just calms down and this is just 2 weeks of bad press? Is it more defections? Is it someone like Kemi just going, actually, you know what, go on then, I'll have you, I'll start a leadership election? What are you watching? Or is it just going to be a miserable slog till November?
I was talking to a Tory MP about this last night, saying, if this is not the Pincher moment, what's the next Pincher moment? But of course, the problem with the Pincher moment was that no one saw it coming, right? So either something that we don't know about yet will happen and this pattern might repeat itself, or I think the next big sort of test is the May the 2nd local elections. And the right wing of the party, of the Tory party, have been saying for a while that that's the key test and that'd be the moment to get rid of Sunak if we can. So I think we limp on.
I guess my follow-up to that is this party, the Conservative Party, just ungovernable at this point? Like, could any other leader be doing any better?
That's a very good point. And the answer is probably not. Because lots of people have checked out. Lots of people looking for new jobs, well aware that the job market's going to be flooded after the election, so that, you know, all putting out feelers to their contacts saying, you know, what can I do when I lose my seat? And I don't think that there is someone who would hold it together better at the moment.
Is this just like the end of the major years?
I wasn't around then, so I'll need like an explainer of what will happen then, Kitty.
Well, the thing that stands out to me, I'm going to skip right by that because Kitty wasn't born either. The thing that I remember from it is the string of defections that came right towards the end of that administration. Mm. We're not really seeing. Okay, we've seen Lee Anderson, that defection in there, prompted by something else. What I'm wondering is that an analogous situation to what we have now? Is it just the fact that it's the end of a very long government and it's sort of inevitable that things would fall apart?
Yeah, people do keep using the phrase fin de siècle, and that sort of that sense that everyone's out for themselves. Even Kemi Badenoch, I mean, she could defend her tweet, but equally, she wasn't towing the party line, right? So, I mean, there's different ways of judging it. But I think we're just... I don't know about analogies between 97. I think that was dominated by sleaze and by Europe. We sort of got past Europe, I think, for the Brexit years. But sleaze and culture wars in the 90s, not quite the same. Who knows? I think we're nearly at a sort of breaking point.
Where does this leave us in terms of, to come back to where we started this whole conversation, Diane Abbott and race? I mean, in some ways, the kind of difficulties of party management are overshadowed that, but yet we risk not talking about the fact that both parties in the past sort of 2 months have both had to have real soul searching about how they tackle identity and race in their own parties. Mm. Is that led to anything, or is that merely just sort of grist to the political mill at this point?
Well, I think it has real world consequences, and I think 7 in 10 Tory candidates for the next Parliament are men. Women are opting out of public life because they see the threats, they see how hideous it is to be an MP sometimes. And most MPs I speak to, men and women, put a brave face on it and say, you know, you can't let them win, you can't let the haters win. But it takes its toll, right? If people are standing outside your house and shouting at your children, why would anybody want to go into that? And actually, I don't know whether talking about it brings it to the fore or whether not talking about it would be better. It's like, do you reply to the reply guy on X or do you ignore him, right? What is fueling the hate and what is fueling the debate? It's I mean, and Rishi Sunak took the unexpected step of making that speech a couple of weeks ago on the Friday night, you know, about extremism. And Michael Gove's up in the comments today talking about the definition of an extremist and they're trying to tighten it. So I think the Tories think they genuinely think there is an issue here. But it's not contained just to the Tory party. It's going to be a dominant theme of this year.
How what is the potential damage to Keir Starmer of Diane Abbott's criticism?
I think Diane Abbott falls into a category of her own in that from going from the embodiment, literally the embodiment of a trailblazer, right, the first black woman in Parliament in 1987, to then trying to make the case for a hierarchy of racism. She wrote in the Observer piece last year that Jews and Irish travellers and others don't suffer racism on the same level that black people do. And there's arguments to be had about that. But Starmer at the time, of course, he was trying to separate himself from the Corbyn area. And, of course, Diane Abbott's a long-time ally of Corbyn. He couldn't stand for that. He said it was anti-Semitic and so forth. And I've been chatting with Labour people this morning, actually, and saying, because senior people in the Labour Party are now saying, we should have Diane back as a Labour MP.
Does this set us up for a particularly different election campaign, a particularly nasty election campaign, when issues like this have been so prominent, and not just this, but also Lee Anderson's comments about the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan? Does that set us up for what's going to be a particularly vicious election campaign, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And it's horrible to watch, isn't it? It's like a kind of slow motion car crash just sort of coming towards you.
And could that precipitate an early election?
What you mean if it gets so nasty that there's nothing else to do?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think so. I just think it's sort of a feature of national life, right? It's not just true of this country. Mm-hmm. It's true of the US and other places in Europe as well, right? It just seems to be that's how politics is conducted, and actually there needs to be a wider public conversation about how people are treated in public life.
That was our political editor, Kitty Donaldson, joining us there. A feature of national life, she said.
Well, we've been speaking about this issue more broadly and what this controversy tells us about the issue of racism in British society as we look towards the election with the writer Nell Zabi, who's written books including Think Like a White Man, Conquering the World While Black. He discusses what he thinks about the Diane Abbott racism row and what it shows about the next election.
I think that we're going in for what I would call a racist and a racism laundering election, essentially. That you're already seeing it in Parliament right now, that Rishi Sunak is cloaking a lot of racism in the fact that he is himself not white. But non-white people have been for centuries vessels for white, what we call white supremacy or racism in many, many areas. And I think we're seeing that today, right now, Rishi Sunak, and I think we'll see a lot more of that during the election. I think that you'll see is racist, dog whistling and head and winking and playing the okie doke or so, and at the same time, cloaking himself and cleansing away his party and maybe perhaps even his donors' clear racism with his own ethnicity. And it won't just be him. I think that there'll be people. What's interesting about Sunak is that he's not particularly good at this. He's pretty basic. There's people who are much better at it than him in his party, such as Kemi Badenoch, for example. But this is the direction of travel of the election this year.
Of course, there is still a symbolism in it, and I take your point there. There is still a symbolism of having the first, you know, non-white prime minister in the UK as well. And that is something that is held up in other parts of the world, too, as being a good example.
I must push back on that. Had Condoleezza Rice have become the first black president of the United States of America, you would have seen African Americans treated with the contempt that, say, many black and brown people, or the, not even just contempt, but the, the blasé-ness that many black and brown people treat the non-election of Rishi Sunak, the appointment of Rishi Sunak, or the de facto default of Rishi Sunak to become the first non-white prime minister. Had, say, a Larry Elder become president of the United States of America, it would be a nightmare for African Americans. But for some bizarre reason, the expectation is that black British people have to celebrate, not just black British people, black and brown British people, Britain, for example, but certainly ethnic minorities have to celebrate the ascension to high office of a politician who often leverages, perhaps not so much Rishi Sunak, but there are others who do it much more than him, but politicians who often leverage their ethnicities to damage us and damage our interests. And it's something that would be clearly understood in other parts of the world, but it's not really documented or covered much in Britain. So as a result, we end up in a situation in which a prime minister is making excuses for keeping 10 million from somebody who fantasized about or who said he would love to shoot a black female member of parliament in real time, whilst he just spoke about extremism and potential violence against MPs. But he keeps that money, but then cloaks or washes away his completely disgraceful nature of the process with the slogan, "I am the first non-white prime minister, but the Conservative Party is the party of diversity." It's absurd.
Come back to you on that, Lillianelles. Is there any way to disentangle race and politics here? Because as you put it, that they are being cloaked in some ways. But you could also come at this to the other side of it, which Labour would say, Diane Abbott doesn't have the whip, she's not a Labour MP. And so in some senses, they disown some of her comments towards anti-Semitism and a hierarchy of race. And yet, on this issue, they have chosen to champion her and say, you know, she is a pioneer, she's a civil rights trailblazer, and she's being treated awfully. And so in this, there is the political point the Labour Party are trying to making, and also the point around race that they are also keen to promote. And so I feel like this is not just a Conservative Party point. There is this kind of intersection of both politics and race. Is there ever any way to kind of analyze them separately, or will they always be hopelessly intertwined?
So I think Diane Abbott has become a literal, almost a near literal political football, certainly a metaphorical one. And you saw it quite play out in Parliament the other day, that the football doesn't get to kick anybody around. The football's just kicked around. So in Parliament, the MPs were the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition and many other politicians were evoking her name. But she was never able to actually evoke her own name or her own pain or her own shame that she's actually received as a result of this. She didn't get to speak for herself. She was literally just being kicked around. So in terms of can race be disentangled from Parliament, this is Britain. This one thing that Britain, this is Britain, and there's one thing that we're very good at doing in Britain is actually pretending at things or so, or being subtle at things. So Britain actually exported racism and white supremacy around the world as far as industrialized slave trade, colonization or so. Britain colonized more Africans than pretty much anybody else or so. But at the same time, Britain cloaked itself in the magical cloth of progressivism, and we create myths. We create myths to pretty much wash away our crimes. We pretend as if we only got into the slave trade to abolish it, or as if we were only in it for like 5 minutes, and then we spend the other hundreds of years just abolishing it. None of this is the case. So in terms of Britain, what we do, it's a very, very, we're a beautiful country, but beautiful people often do the ugliest things, as has been said somewhere.
And, how do we address this? How can Britain as a society and the political class try to address this and some of the issues that you've raised?
I think that we shouldn't run away from matters of race in the slightest bit. I think that we should run towards it, and we should run towards it in an open and honest manner with people who are going to speak in good faith. We had a commission that was looking into race in Britain, and it was packed full of people who were effectively stooges of the right, sometimes love to pander to the far right. And effectively, that report was panned even by the United Nations as an attempt to normalize white supremacy. But I think that if the Labour Party, who again are not particularly better than the Conservative Party when it comes to these sorts of things, and they too have reduced Diane Abbott to political football, as I wrote in the I newspaper quite recently, if the Labour Party were serious about tackling racism and making Britain some sort of anti-racist society, then the Labour Party, the incoming Labour Party government, would have to make sure that, look, we're engaging, we're almost like wiping the slate clean, that we recognise that things, atrocities were conducted over the last few centuries and over the last few decades and until recently. But how can we create a more perfect society that moves forward together as a collective? Case in point, if you look at Barack Obama, when Barack Obama was in hot water after his pastor Jeremiah Wright, some comments with him were evoked. Barack Obama came and spoke in front of the American flags for 45 minutes straight and spoke about race in America in a way that actually left me so inspired. That really inspired me. I thought it was such a brilliant speech. And I thought Sunak was going to have a similar moment in front of Downing Street. And it was just the cheapest, crassest thing that I've ever heard. So I think Sunak, I think that we need better thinkers on race and racism, not just people who are going to say what you want to hear, but people who really are speaking and thinking the long interest of not just what's good for me or good for my bank account or can I get into the House of Lords if I say these things, but people who are thinking what is in the best interest of Britain, not just today, not in 2 months' time, but in 100, 150, 200 years from now.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Niles, but from what you've said so far, it sounds like you say there's a systemic issue in politics, in the Conservative Party, in the Labour Party, in politics as a whole, and society as a whole in the UK, towards race. Presumably, how we change that also comes from the black community and how we would create this perfect society you talk about. I've noticed the Labour Party and the Conservative Party having real issues getting black people to run, to be selected, to be MPs. What would you say to the community about how they should engage with politics?
No, they don't have a problem getting black people to run to be MPs. They have an abundance of it. It's just that the actual selection process is actually quite abusive. One of the most dedicated, somebody who inspired me when I was young, a man called Maurice McLeod, he was a journalist. He inspired me to get into journalism or to become a writer. He was somebody whose work I read from when I was very, very young. I always admired him. He ran to become an MP. He ran to become an MP in the seat, I think it was Peckham or somewhere. And he wasn't, and the unions endorsed him. As you'd expect, he was a profound, inspiring person. He was completely dismissed. We see, say, for example, drummers of pop bands getting invited to come and run to become Labour MPs. But we're seeing great quality, and I don't know much about the drummer who was selected, to be told, but we've seen great quality black people who have really put in so much work in the community, not just handing out leaflets for the Labour Party, but were really champions of the community, people who probably could stand as independents in a fairer society and win in a true democracy, but they're not invited to come and run for the party. They're often treated poorly and then given an OBE or an MBE to keep quiet and not rock the boat. That's not good enough, I'm afraid. So both parties have no problem getting people to run. In fact, the Conservative Party, going all the way back to John Stewart in the 1800s, the Conservative Party have a better record of actually elevating black people to higher office a lot quicker. But those people often tend to be people who have come along for the purpose of conserving society in its most vicious of manners, particularly on matters of race.
That was the author Nels Abbey speaking to us a little earlier, and we should note that his views and comments don't reflect those of Bloomberg Radio or Bloomberg News. Both Rishi Sunak and Kemi Badenoch have rejected accusations of racism in the past.
And in this Dan Abbott controversy, Kemi Badenoch was the first government minister to label comments that sparked this controversy as racist. During a speech last year, she also said, "I tell my children this is the best country in the world to be black because it's a country that sees people, not labels."
In Parliament on Wednesday, Rishi Sunak said there was no place for racism in Britain and that the government that he leads is living proof of that. Previously, the Prime Minister has spoken of his own experience of racist abuse while growing up, but he says the country has made progress in tackling it since then. That is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineers were Marufal Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.